This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we've got a special program devoted entirely to the economy. Is Wall Street in crisis, or more broadly, is the capitalist system in crisis? We have Rick Wolf, professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts, his son Max Wolf, and John Ehrenberg, professor of political science at Long Island University.
One question we've asked these three people is, what can be done? Do we go back to a more of a Keynesian model and trickle down some more wealth to the working class, or do we need something more revolutionary? Hear what they think on Law and Disorder. Stay with us. We're glad to have Dahlia back, even though she's on the phone, and we wanted her to give us an update about a case that has been close to her as well as to Amnesty International, which is the Troy Davis case. Okay, now we came within 2 hours of execution, Dahlia.
Yep.
What happened?
2 hours of within 2 hours of execution, the Supreme Court issued a stay, which basically said this person can stay alive until we decide whether or not we're going to hear his case. We expect to hear today whether or not the Supreme Court will hear that case. If they do not hear the case, then we expect the state of Georgia to reissue the execution warrant, the death warrant. And he could be executed any time from mid to late October of this month. If the Supreme Court does grant cert, does say they'll hear the case, the stay becomes indefinite until the case is heard. And so right now, there are still things that people can do. Log on to amnestyusa.org/abolish. You can write a letter that will not be delivered directly to the board of the Georgia Board of Pardons and Paroles, but instead they'll be collected in Amnesty International's Atlanta office, and they're going to be sent from the Atlanta office to the Board of Pardons and Parole at the appropriate time. You can also send the Atlanta office a fax for the board, 404-876-2276, or you can do it online. Go to amnestyusa.org. The day before his execution, the night before his last execution, because actually he's been up for execution twice, one in 2007 and one most recently a few weeks ago, Troy Davis wrote a letter to everybody who's been working on his behalf and to all his thousands of supporters, and he mailed it to his sister. I'd like to read a portion of it.
Yeah, thanks, Dahlia. Please read it.
To all, this is a message from Troy Anthony Davis. I want to thank all of you for your efforts and dedication to human rights and human kindness in the past year. I've experienced such emotion, joy, sadness, and never-ending faith. It is because of all of you that I am alive today. As I look at my mail from across the globe, from places I have never, ever dreamed I would know about, and people speaking languages and expressing cultures and religions, I am humbled by the emotion that fills my heart with overwhelming, overflowing joy. I can't even explain the insurgent emotion I feel when I try to express the strength I draw from you all. It compounds my faith, and it shows me yet again that this is not a case about the death penalty. This is not a case about Troy Davis. This is a case about justice and the human spirit to see justice prevail.
Dahlia Hashad, head of the America Program for Amnesty International, thanks so much for that update. We want to give a big shout-out here on Law and Disorder to our longtime dear friend and comrade, Dr. Alan Berkman, who's in the hospital fighting cancer yet again. Alan was arrested and imprisoned for 8 years, served time in infamous Marion Prison, actually. What was his crime? He treated somebody with a gunshot wound, and when the cops came around to ask him who it was that he treated, he refused to tell them. He said it was the doctor-patient privilege, and it was none of their business. They pursued him. They hounded him. He went underground, and willy-nilly wound up in federal prison, serving, like I said, 8 years. When he was in prison, he contracted cancer. He diagnosed himself. They hated him. They hated him because he was a communist. They hated him because he was Jewish. And they hated him because he was a supporter of the black struggle. They wouldn't give him medical help. It was at that time that Bill Kunstler and his law firm stepped in, got Alan medical help. He was operated on for stomach cancer. When he woke up from the surgery, he found himself chained to the hospital gurney. got cancer again, was sick again, finally got out of it for 8 years. Miraculously, his medical license was saved. He wound up starting a AIDS hospice up in the Bronx, and after some years doing that, he was offered a professorship at Columbia in their School of Public Health. In fact, he became the chairman of the department for a while. He was renowned throughout the world for his international AIDS work, especially his travels to South Africa and the Dominican Republic. He's now in the hospital fighting. We send out this message to you, Alan. We're with you, and we hope you're listening out there. We send our best from Law and Disorder.
In a piece of sad news, I just received a note from my colleagues in Berlin, particularly Wolfgang Kolick, who I work with at the European Center for Constitutional and Human Rights, sent me a note about a death in Argentina. The person who died is Ellen Pincus de Marx. She was born Ellen Marx in Germany in 1921, fled Germany in 1938, moved to Argentina, where in 1976 her daughter Nora Marx was disappeared. An interesting aspect of Ellen Marx's case, and particularly her daughter Nora Marx, who has still disappeared, is the Germans were pressured to begin a prosecution of the Argentinians for the disappearance of a German national, Nora Marx. However, they claim that she was not a German national because when Ellen Marx left Germany in 1938, she was stripped of her citizenship automatically for leaving. And of course, because Nora Marx was disappeared, she couldn't reclaim her citizenship. And therefore, the German prosecutors refused to go ahead and prosecute the Argentinians who were involved in the abduction and disappearance of Nora Marx. So it's a sad death. This is the woman who struggled, who I believe was part of the Plaza de Mayo women in Argentina.
You had this Nazi government taking away a person's citizenship and the Argentinian government standing on the shoulders of that decision.
And then the German government refusing to look into the disappearance of a person who should be and is a German citizen, but because she was disappeared, she couldn't reclaim her German citizenship when the Germans changed the law back so the Jews who fled and others in the 30s could reclaim it. And so they stood on that and refused the prosecution of the Argentinian dictatorship during the Dirty War.
So the Germans and the Argentinians stood together in creating a legal black hole.
That's right. And Germany is still, lawyer Wolfgang Kolick and the ECCHR, the European Center, are still pursuing cases in Argentina against a variety of defendants, including Mercedes-Benz.
You know, Michael, I understand that a brigade from Iraq is going to be dispatched to patrol the streets of the United States. A brigade is, when last I was in the military, a group of men of at least 250. They're commanded by a brigadier general, hence brigade, and they're coming home to patrol the streets against the Posse Comitatus Act in case of civil disorders. Have you read that?
Well, I read something about this, Michael. What it seems to me is they are coming home, as I understand it. They won't be put out on the streets yet. I think they'll be garrisoned. But I think the point is they're getting ready if there is, and possibly it was the economic crisis, if there is a huge revolt of some sort in this country, they want to have the military here and ready, and they may just put them in the streets to suppress that. But it's unclear now. It's unclear, you know, how much strength the Posse Comitatus Act has anymore. The Congress has slowly made it like a Swiss cheese in terms of the holes. But it certainly is the thinking of this country, the Constitution, as well as our statutes, that the military should not be used for patrolling the streets of America. Well, and we're seeing that broken down post 9/11.
Founding fathers are great scholars of Roman history. And when Julius Caesar allowed the troops to come back into Rome, that was the beginning and the end of the Roman Republic. They crossed the river, the Rubicon, came back into Rome, and now we got this brigade from Iraq crossing the Atlantic to come back to the United States.
Yes, the Rubicon was north of Rome. Caesar was coming back from Gaul, and after he crossed the Rubicon, do you remember what he said?
No.
The die is cast, which meant that was it, that he essentially had done it. What do they mean?
What you cast metal in.
Right, that's what they
and
mean.
Once it's cast, right, you it's can't done. Reshape it.
And I think that when you think about Julius Caesar, the reason supposedly that Brutus killed him and said, and basically death to all tyrants was because he had become, at least according to many, a dictator. So it's a good point about bringing troops into a democracy. It's one thing to use troops outside of a democracy to kill lots of people. It's another thing to use them in a democracy, right? I mean, but your point, Michael, has always been to see what we're doing at home, just look what we're doing abroad.
Today, we are witnessing not a Wall Street crisis, but a generalized crisis of capitalism. It's something that we've predicted over the years, and it's now happening. Why? Simply because people that produce things in this economy aren't paid enough to buy back what they produce. There's all kinds of surplus capital out there. It's not used for productive means, but it's become speculative capital. People haven't, in the United States, received an increase in real wages in almost 30 years. So we now have a collapse of this whole debt structure, and it's brought down insurance companies, banks, Wall Street banks, commercial banks, and it threatens to bring the economy of the United States, and in fact, the economy of the world, because the United States is 25% of the world economy, to a grinding halt. We're joined by Professor Richard Wolff, who is a professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts, in fact, one-time chair of that department. He teaches in Massachusetts as well as in the New York Marxist School, of which he's a board member. Professor Richard Wolff, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Well, glad to be here.
We're speaking with you after Congress ditched the first bailout proposal and before another vote is going to be taken. I want the audience to understand that. But pulling back from this specific, what they've called a crisis of Wall Street, Michael and I have read your articles and we'll post on our website. And you call it not so much a crisis of Wall Street, but a crisis of the capitalist system. And I wanted you to talk with respect to that. The critics of the bailout are calling it socialism for the rich. I think that's kind of a misuse of the term socialism. But my question to you is, what's going on? If you were to analyze it and project what you would call socialism for everybody who's not rich, what would you be for?
Well, let me first try to explain what I mean by calling it a crisis of capitalism. I am very distressed, to say the least, by the constant putting of the adjective financial in front of the word crisis. That is, a crisis we surely have, but limiting it to finance as if it were only there and had only peculiarly to do with banking and credit is really a terrible misunderstanding of what's going on. The financial system of the United States, money lending, credit, banking, all of that, is deeply embedded in and completely dependent on the rest of the economy, the production of goods and services by companies large and small and their distribution all over the place. And likewise, what happens in finance is not only dependent on what happens everywhere else, but vice versa. In other words, this is a crisis that would not have exploded in the financial sector had not the conditions for it been developing over decades everywhere in the economy, which is why even if the bill passes, that is the new bailout version that the Senate will vote on tonight and the House is expected to vote over the next 48 hours, even if it passes, this is probably an important contribution, but far short of what would be necessary, because it is only about finance, it is only about the viability of banks, and that's simply too narrow a focus to deal with this problem.
What do you have to deal with, Rick?
You have to deal with the underlying causes. I mean, to give you a snapshot picture, for 150 years, from 1820 to 1970, the American economy, uniquely in the world, delivered to most of its workers a rising standard of living. Their wages went up every decade for those 150 years, and they used that money to buy more things, which is one of the reasons why Americans are so much more consumption-focused than people almost anywhere else on the earth. They were able to develop that feeling about measuring their own self-worth in terms of what they could consume because they were safe in doing that, since each generation was able to consume at a higher standard than the one before. America came to be thought of as unique and special. Immigrants from around the world came here for a very good reason. And then in the 1970s, this culture, so focused on consumption, paid for out of rising wages, suddenly discovered itself in a new situation. For the last 30 years, the real wages of American workers did not go up. That is a fundamental shift in a society that affects every worker, whether he or she makes bed sheets or hamburgers, and is not at all specially related to finance, But it's a fundamental shift. And when the American working people, who had come to measure and expect rising standard of consumption, could no longer afford that with the wages that they got from the hours that they worked, they reacted as people might expect. They worked more hours, and they borrowed the money that was necessary to get into a position to afford more consumption. And right there is the first beginning of what we now have, a population that is increasingly paying for rising consumption by exhausting themselves in hours of work and taking on ever more debt. Look at it from the point of view of the workers, or if you do, you see exhaustion and anxiety. You see 30 years of working people in circumstances that make their lives strained, pressurized, that undercut their feelings for one another. They're exhausted, they're worried. Of course our family values fall apart. Of course our rates of divorce go crazy. Of course our dependence on legal and illegal drugs zooms. We are a population whose families under extraordinary pressure. And let me just say the other side of it. For business, everything was wonderful. Even as for the mass of the working people, everything got terrible. Think about 30 years during which every year American workers became more productive. The last 30 years are the age of the computer. Everybody could produce more goods and services because he or she was working with a computer. They produced more each year, but their wages never went up.
Why didn't wages go up despite the increase in productivity since the 1970s? I think that's key, isn't it?
Right. There are several factors that came together to make this fantasy of the business community come true. First, with the globalization of high-tech and transportation and communication, American corporations began in their competition not only with one another, but with the resurgence of Europe and Japan, having recovered from World War II by the 1970s, with all of this going on and the rising of competition, American corporations began to need to find cheaper workers. And to make a long story short, they moved out of the United States because it was profitable to do so. And that left workers here without work. And the unemployed workers who left behind when the corporations moved abroad began to compete with those who were still working by offering to work less. Wages, therefore, don't rise. Number two, we brought in waves of immigrants, having not done so for several decades, and they came in for a whole host of reasons, and they competed for jobs. And women, because the family wage wasn't going up with the husband, the women went out to work in order to build up the family's capacity to keep consuming, and so they competed for jobs. Plus, a new computer substituted machines for jobs. So when you put all of that together, the immigrants, the women, the machines, and the export or outsourcing of jobs, wages stopped rising.
Now, Rick, the one thing that I think if I were a listener here, I would say, well, are you saying you're blaming immigrants for the fact that wages didn't go up, or you're blaming women? Is that what's going on here?
It's not a question of blaming. It's a question of understanding why these things happened. Absolutely, it is the case that you suddenly had, in the language of economics, a fall in the demand for American workers because corporations were leaving for cheaper workers outside, and you had a rise in the supply of workers because of immigration, because of women. If you put those factors together, and especially if you understand that the women were entering the labor force partly because they had to maintain the family standard of living. And the immigrants had to come here because they had to, since the United States, interacting with this country's economies from which they came, left them no choice.
The problem that I'm having is you're making me think that the solution here is to kick out all the immigrants.
Well,
and I'm not sure that's where you want to go here.
No, that's certainly not where I want to go, but it is an important thing for you to say because you can be very sure that there will be major social forces in the United States who will take advantage of the current crisis to come up with exactly that kind of solution.
If that's not the solution, what are the solutions?
Yeah, Professor Richard Wolff, you're a Marxist economist at the University of Massachusetts. You obviously don't buy this extravagant bailout of Wall Street. You've got your own ideas on what should be done. If we had our own political organization and we were running Rick Wolff for president and you were in the debate, what would you say we should do tomorrow to help the economy and to help everybody but not the rich?
Well, what I would begin by saying is, if you have a problem that has built up over all these years in the ways that I tried to sketch, you're not going to solve it in the ways that are being proposed now, neither by, you know, extreme right-wing anti-immigration moves or by trying to force women back out of the labor force into the household. The reason you're not going to see that last or even develop very far is none of those proposals will work. The women will not go back. The families will not give up their consumption. The immigrants can't go back from where they came. The economies there couldn't cope with it, et cetera, et cetera.
What about giving $700 billion to the investment banks?
Yeah, that's a quick fix in order to relieve the immediate pressure. It doesn't solve the underlying problem. Let me try to get at it in a slightly different way. If you look at the American economy today, there are many problems that are not being given attention because of all the focus on finance. Every major retailer of clothing, of furniture, of cars is cutting back. The layoffs are beginning. There is a broad, what we call in economics, recession underway. There is no stopping it at this point. You have a major cutback, and it's globalized so that every part of the world is cutting back, which feeds in and does it to everyone else. Therefore, the kind of general solution I'm about to sketch for you is a response to the reality and not a response to this fictionalized focus on finance as if it could do the problem. We need a fundamental reorganization of the American economic system. At the base, let me sketch what it might look like. We have to put Americans into jobs that pay them a wage that is going to go up with whatever extra productivity they can achieve. The only way to do that, and therefore to stop the cascading mountains of debt that workers got into, the very debt that then stimulated banks to compete with one another to get their hands on the profits from that debt, producing a spiral of financial mismanagement and risk-taking that's collapsing all around us now, the fundamental change has to be to make it no longer necessary for workers to rely on debt, to put them in a position so that the government, together with the working people, can organize the economic system in a way that serves their needs and reduces the banking community and so on to the kind of secondary adjuncts of a functioning economy that they were supposed to be and that they can be once again. But this is not going to be done by the people who run the corporations of the United States. The name of that group is called the Board of Directors. Every corporation, whether it has 10 employees or it has a million employees like Walmart, is governed by a small group of people, 15 to 25 individuals, who are members of a board of directors. They are used to being in positions of power. They make decisions in classical ways. They've been doing that for 150 years. There is where the change has to begin. The need in this society is to make the organization and the decisions of corporations, who do most of the business in this society, run to a different tune, work in a different way. And that's not going to be achieved if we rely on the old existing structures manned by the same old existing groups. So my basic proposal is that we reorganize our businesses, that we change the way a business works so that the people who depend on it most, the people who work there, become their own board of directors. What we need to do is to do what most Americans in their fantasy already say they want. If you ask college students in America, or high school students, what would you like to be 5 years from now when you finished your education and you want a job? Two-thirds of them say, I want to be my own boss. I think that's a brilliant insight. Corporations could be reorganized so that the workers in them become, collectively, their own boss. here's how it would be working. Monday to Thursday, you come and you do your job, as you always did. You make software, you make shirts, you make hamburgers, you sell music, whatever it is. On Friday, you come to work, but your work is very different. You sit around in meetings and you decide what is to be produced, what is to be done with the profits, how are they to be used to build your jobs and to build your communities. You're going to care about your communities because you are the people who live in the communities half the time. You only work half the time. So for the first time, the people who make the business decisions will be the communities who have to live with the results of those decisions. The basic principle of running a business in this way is a principle to which we usually give the name democracy. It is the government of the economic institution by the people who depend on it, rather than creating the production system in such a way that a handful of people, the bosses, are set against the mass of people who work there in a conflicted situation that periodically makes one or the other or both of them behave in antagonistic ways which destroy the whole community, which is where we are now.
Rick, here I'm sitting here listening to this, and I understand that. What concerns me a bit here is it's a fantasy at this point in our lives. And maybe, of course, we have to fight for those kind of goals and fight for what's right. But in the end, the idea of essentially having workers control all these major businesses and small businesses, at least it doesn't seem very realistic to me. We're not even close to that in a laissez-faire capitalist system. The most I could say if I were looking at it as a non-economist is we're going to go back to more of a regulated economy like we did in the 30s. And yes, in 30 more years, it'll be undone again. And maybe we have the long-term goal that you have. But if you were asking someone, isn't that what you would have to say? Don't we need we need more regulation now. It's not going to solve the problem. It'll at least go somewhere.
How do you transition to that? That's what we're asking right. You.
But I would ask you to think of that the question might be a little bit different. If we had been talking here, you and I, 6 months ago, we would have said that anyone who described the situation we're in now was living in a fantasy world. It might one day happen, but we're not about to see the literal disintegration of, for example, the basic structure. There are no more investment banks. 6 months ago, the investment banks were the most profitable institutions in the society. If I had said to you then, they'll all be gone. There will no longer be an investment bank. Half of them will have collapsed and the other half will have been in such terrible shape that they will have been merged with other things. You would have thought I was nuts.
I would have. I had read Ernest Mandel. I thought that this speculative capital madness was going to crash.
We would have thought there was a 10% chance. And if you read the book The Black Swan, when you look at it in retrospect, looking at it from back then, there was a 10 or 15% chance by people who really thought about it.
Good, good. That's where I was going. You're saving me time. I want you to think about the 10 or 15% chance that there will be people who are not willing at this point to resume a struggle for reforms that we've just had 30 years of illustration of them being undone. And keep in mind, not only will there be large numbers of workers who are not going to be moved by this, who will remember that even under the time of regulation from the 1930s to the 1970s, that their condition wasn't all that good, that in the end, many workers voted for Reagan, switched over from the Democrats because they felt betrayed, that the hope and the dream of that reformed capitalism was turning into its opposite, and they were angry about it. Keep also in mind that we have now boards of directors that have a 35-year history, at least, of learning wonderful techniques to evade reforms, to undo reforms, to rewrite reforms. Lobbying is developed on a new scale. In point of fact, the option of regulating capitalism in the way we did before is very dubious because the people who supported it last time will support it less this time. And the people who opposed it are now geniuses at how to undo it and avoid it. It's not a workable solution. For America, the response to re-regulation is really a sigh and the comment, been there, done that. And in fact, if the left in America wants to have a chance to solve this problem rather than to repeat the sorry history of the last 40 years, which in the history of the American left is a period of uninterrupted decline, then they have to come up with a new analysis and a new target and a new program. Otherwise, their chances of influencing will continue to be as marginal as they are now.
So let me ask you a bottom-line question, Rick Wolf. Are you supporting the bailout that's being supported by both the Republican and the Democratic Party, by both McCain and Obama? Do you support that bailout?
Yes. Let me tell you why. Is it a solution to the problem? Absolutely not. Is it unfair? Absolutely it is. But you're in a situation in which this system is grinding to a halt. The level of contradictions and conflicts and self-interested hoarding of money by banks is literally bringing this system to its knees. And capitalism is nothing if not a system that has well-worked-out mechanisms for making sure that any economic problem that is encountered is shifted by the people at the top to the people at the bottom. Those in the greatest danger from the economic collapse that is now happening around us are the two-thirds of the people at the bottom of our society. Workers, unemployed, housewives, students, retirees, that's who's going to take it on the chin as this system unfolds. And I believe, absent a strong, organized left of the sorts even that you have in European countries, the tendency for folks under the kinds of pressure that are now threatening us in our culture is to move to the right, not the left. We need to have a situation that is not so dire that the possibility for political work, for education, for people to understand not only what the problems are, but the kinds of new solutions I've tried to suggest, that we have the time and the space in which to put those forward. If we don't, if we flail around in our rage and our frustration by mumbling things about fat cats and greedy people and those at the top have made a fortune, and they will be fine as this system goes down. It's the rest of us that are at risk, and I don't want that to happen because I think that is politically dangerous, and I am sure that I can explain, which I've been doing on radio, television, and more, talking like this than I've done in the past 20 years in the last month, I am sure that when you explain that to working people, they understand.
Professor Rick Wolf at the University of Massachusetts. I want to remind our audience that October 6th, Rick will be speaking at the New York Marxist School, the Brecht Forum, 451 West Street between Bank and Bethune at 7:30. We invite you all to come on down, listen to Rick, say hello. Say hello to the host of Law and Disorder. Rick Wolf, thank you very, very much for your thoughtful comments on what you've called this crisis, not of Wall Street, but a crisis of capitalism.
Thank you very much for the opportunity. This is the kind of educational work that your program is doing that is the most important thing to make there be a chance to come out of this crisis with a real advance for most Americans rather than a catastrophe.
Thank you, Rick.
Thank you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
With the collapse of several major brokerage houses on Wall Street and the federal government taking over the mortgage industry, will probably go down as one of the major crises in the capitalist economy since 1929. Today we have both Max Frodwolf, an economist who teaches at the New School and writes for the Huffington Post, and John Ehrenberg, author of Servants of Wealth, The Right's Assault on Economic Justice, who teaches political science at Long Island University. We're certainly living in extraordinary times with what's happening on Wall Street, with the right-wing populist Republican Party trying to tap into that discontent. I think people are feeling very uneasy, and we're glad to have you down at the studio and really wanted to get your take on what's recently happened, where we are and where you think we're going.
Look, my sense of this is, I've been thinking about it on the way down, my sense of this is that the economic troubles is really the direct villain here is the Bush tax cuts and this general ideology of low taxation and this notion somehow that if you convince Americans that they should not pay taxes, but you've got a government that has to borrow money, what you've got is a tremendous infusion of capital from the world into the country, and that capital has to find a place, and capital being what it is, gets repackaged and reorganized and redone. And that's, I think, I mean, Max may disagree, but I think that's really what's behind the this frenzy of irresponsible borrowing and lending that's driven us into this mess. Look, as long as you've got a government that tells the American people that you can spend and spend and spend and borrow and borrow and borrow and consume and consume and consume without raising your taxes, and that you're going to drive the country into deficit, but the country's productive enough to overcome that through its sheer size and kind of battering power, you're going to have a situation where there are a lot of lenders around who have a lot of money that's been coming in from outside lenders who are buying up treasury certificates, and that capital has got to be spent. It can't sit still. And I think that's what's behind the haste and the willingness and the ease with which these bankers for years and years and now have been packaging these esoteric instruments and selling them to people, frankly, who they shouldn't have been selling them to. And I think that's what's gotten us into this mess. In that sense, it's really a classical Marxian problem of oversupply.
Yeah, I totally agree with you.
I still need more explanation.
Well, maybe the economists can put this in terms more technical terms.
Well, it depends. I think the Bush tax cuts threw gasoline on a fire, and I think that fire is related to basically the fact that there's been limited or negative some years and slight shallow positive some years wage growth for the majority of Americans. Meanwhile, the productive capacity of global enterprise has skyrocketed, and the way to make money is to find a way to produce something with very low wages. This creates a classic problem of insufficient aggregate demand. Right. In other words, we can make it cheap, we can even find this nice young 11-year-old here in the rainforest to work in the factory for a whopping 39 cents an hour, but all of that comes to naught if you can't find someone somewhere who will buy it.
The ideological piece of this is absolutely correct, that you've got a period of wage stagnation where people basically can't afford to buy what they produce, and a period where ideologically the possibilities of actually politicians going to the American people and saying, look, we have got to raise taxes and we're going to raise everybody's taxes by 20%, that's impossible. So you've got this kind of classic problem where the political apparatus at the moment is absolutely paralyzed from doing what has to be done, and you've got this spinning ideology of high consumption, wage stagnation, borrowed money, increasing indebtedness, the bubble keeps on expanding until finally, you know, it can't anymore. I mean, I think that's absolutely what's been going on.
Now, why can't they raise taxes? You say they just can't go to the American people. And they need to raise taxes because of the debt, I presume, is what you're
saying. We can't go on like this. You can't – I mean, it's true. You cannot go on pretending as if you can borrow your way out of these contradictions. You just can't do it. All it does is it throws oil in the fire, or it just intensifies the nature of the contradiction. So at some point, if Americans want stuff from the state, which they do, they can no longer pretend that they can have stuff from the state at the same time having the lowest rate of taxation of anybody in the advanced industrial world. It just doesn't work that way. At the end of the day, though, the conversation that we have got to have in this country is the old conversation about Keynesianism. And it's true. The only way to actually put this on some kind of rational basis upon which we can base our discussions is, how are we going to stimulate aggregate demand here at home? How are we going to redistribute income? Look, the question
– The real question, if I'm trying to understand, is you're trying to say you want to have a consuming – not have, but we have that – And we don't want to do it through debt. We want to do it through actually wage increases.
That's
essentially,
right.
if I'm
that's
taking
right.
it as a very that's simple.
Right.
Say
right.
it in
yeah.
how you want to. But
that's the basis of Keynesianism. And Keynesianism is ideologically predisposed to a certain measure of wealth, of wealth equality and of redistribution. That will run against 25 years of the contemporary political history in this country. But it's, you know, just as the right rose to power by claiming that Keynesianism could no longer deal with stagflation, so the opening now exists for the left to begin to make the point, the claim that it's now time for old-fashioned Keynesian stimulus because it can no longer deal with the consequences of these bubbles exploding all the time.
And how would you do that? Let's give me some examples of that.
Well, look, if I were, you know, if I were a Democratic candidate for president,
right.
You know, I'd be talking about – and Obama, to his credit, he is a little bit talking about this. He's talking about higher taxes and redistributive social policies. So he's talking about taxing people who make $280,000 or more. He's talking about tax breaks for the lower elements of society so they can consume more. He's talking about infrastructure. He's talking about job retraining. All the stuff that Obama actually is talking about are a reinvigorated model of social spending. Now, he hasn't yet come out flat out and said, look, we have got to rethink our position about the role of the state in contemporary society. We've got to rethink our position about taxes. He probably can't in the current environment. So what you've got with the Obama campaign is kind of a soft intimation of a revival of Keynesian economics and of politics as well, without actually naming it. And probably given everything that's been going on in this country for 25 years, that's as good as you can expect at the moment.
If you had your druthers, rather than just something that's as good as you can expect, what would you want?
Well, I think that the only way any of this is going to happen is with powerful social movements that exert pressure on Congress and on the parties from outside. I mean, I think that's the law of American politics. If I had my way, we'd be talking about single-payer health insurance. We'd be talking about a fully socialized system of delivering health care. You know, we all have our laundry list of this.
I'd like to hear it.
Well, I'd be talking about utter transparency in every single political process that goes on. I'd be talking about publicly funded elections. There's a whole laundry list of things that I have.
What would you do for unemployment?
Well, you know, all kinds of public spending is what's necessary. I mean, Obama's right. Look, the country's infrastructure has been deliberately neglected for the better part of a generation now, whether it's bridges in Minnesota or levees in New Orleans, or just take a look around this city. I mean, so there are tens of billions of dollars of public spending that would generate jobs, that would generate demand, put money in people's pockets, and at the same time address these infrastructural concerns. That's a good way to start. That's FDR. You know, that's the CCC.
What would you do about trade unions?
I would pass all kinds of legislation making it easier, including the Freedom of Choice Act. I mean, I would pass all kinds of legislation making it easier to organize trade unions. I would certainly punish employers for illegal activity when they fire workers and otherwise get in the way of union drives. There's a whole panoply. You know, there were people saying that the old industrial politics of the left, organized around the working class, were over and done with. This is the basis of Bill Clinton's third way. You know, the country is no longer an industrial country. Therefore, since people aren't engaged in industry anymore, they don't think like industrial workers, and the politics of progressivism these days have to be organized around lifestyle and autonomy and freedom of choice. And here all of a sudden we are in the year 2008 in a so-called post-industrial economy. And where we've come to is that the stimulus measures that are necessary and the public spending measures that are necessary and the encouragement to trade union organizations that are absolutely essential, all of this is the New Deal writ large. It is time for to rethink a new deal in this country, and that requires an active public sector with active state activity and active stimulation of domestic demand and putting money in people's pockets. It's, you know, this is old stuff. Is this socialism? No. But is it far better than what we're going to get? Absolutely. And that's what people ought to be talking about. And frankly, I think that politically and ideologically, things are shifting enough and the shift is dramatic enough these days that it's going to be possible to put these questions on the table in the not too distant future.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think two things are happening at once. It'd be possible to put these questions on the table, but I think also the right-wing ideologues are going to put other questions on the table. And there's real confrontations brewing in this terrible situation, just as, for example, those confrontations brewed in Germany when their economy went into the tank.
Yeah, the history of a lot of this, I mean, this does follow an old pattern. The pattern is for periods of capitalist reorganization presided over by the Republican Party, with the Democrats as the junior partner. At some point, the country gets run into a ditch, right? Whether it's the 1920s right. or whether, right? Yeah. And that's what's happening now. And the Democrats step forward as the party of reform and the party of to limit the excesses and get things back on track. And that's what you see developing now. Now, it may be a couple of election cycles before this really takes shape.
Right. Last time we interviewed you, of course, we weren't in as big a ditch. You saw it there, but you weren't as big a ditch.
And here we are.
And here we are, and we have...
There is going to be a debate between the free marketeers and the supply-siders who have been running the country for the last 25 years, but who are manifestly and demonstrably incapable of doing so in the future. So
yeah, I think there's going to be a debate if it's between the Republicans and the Democrats on this question. Well, Everybody's going to be on one side of the table. Obama and his advisors from the Chicago School say, we're for the free market also. So where's the debate going to come from?
Well, I think Obama is a free marketer. He describes himself as more respectful of markets than Democrats have been in the past. There was a very good piece about his economic stuff, by the way, about 2 or 3 weeks ago in the Times Magazine section. But these are all basically Clinton people. He does have Jared Bernstein and some pro-labor types to whom he listens. But basically what you get from Obama is warmed over Clintonism.
That's right. True, that's right? Exactly right.
It's still the case that Obama, I think, is smart enough to recognize the need for the downward redistribution of wealth. And look, 25 years later, this is Bolshevism. I mean, this is, you know, you got to take what you got. And we don't have a whole hell of a lot, but believe me, it's a lot better than what we've had. And I think what all of this means is that even as we should keep our powder dry about Obama, he's going to make possible a set of openings and a set of debates and discussions that have not been present on the national scene for a generation. And this is not the end of the road. This is not the socialist salvation of the country. This is the creation of an opening for organization, for social movements, for debate and for discussion, and for actual ideological struggle, which we haven't had for a long time.
I have a less positive set of assumptions about an Obama administration. His economic advisors are pretty much as far right free market types as you can get. The sort of big two would be Goolsbee, who was considered more or less in the field to be a bit of a fringe free marketeer at the University of Chicago Business School, so not a classic Keynesian by any stretch. He would probably have heart palpitations if he were described as such, and those who know him would probably be befuddled. Mr. Furman, despite having an interesting and varied past work experience, seems to have spent a lot of the recent years as the free trade advocate for Walmart, which isn't the standard kind of Keynesian credentialing. I do think that whoever gets elected is going to be much more open to and much more Keynesian in their policy approach package than anything we've seen probably in some time.
So actually, for the reasons that
because there's not a whole hell of a lot of choice.
There's no alternative here,
exactly. Right? I mean, there's probably not going to be a whole heck of a lot
when you
of choice.
Say, when you guys, I just want to, for our audience, when you guys both say Keynesian, I know John described it as a sort of consumer society that can afford, has enough wages and equality to be able to buy goods, essentially.
You need to have – it's basically mass – the Fordism is mass production for mass consumption associated with Henry Ford.
Right.
And there's nothing particularly progressive about it because Henry Ford was also a close friend and traveling companion of Hitler's and not usually associated with the far left.
Right.
But his idea was if he wanted to make cars profitably, he had to make a lot of cars and he had to have somebody out there who'd buy a lot of cars. And the answer to the question was figure out a way to extract so much value from your workers that you could afford to give them enough to buy what you produced. Right. It doesn't have to be progressive. And, you know, what I think is that you've cornered a too-big-to-fail giant with a limited number of options and half the world's military capability. I wouldn't want to be the guy who corners the gigantic, muscle-bound methamphetamine addict in the corner of the club to throw him out. You know, it just seems like a not altogether sweet gig.
That's why, in many ways, that's why this is a very dangerous moment also. See?
You know, John, that's exactly, you know, I remember when Palin was nominated, Michael and I was talking, I actually saw, not in a sophisticated way you and Max are talking, but that I saw what she represents to America is the myths of America, the frontier, the so-called independence, the not need of the state, all the God stuff, the whole business.
Right.
And to the extent that they put that back into office, that's pretty serious.
That's right.
It's playing. But and sitting here in New York, I just don't know how America is thinking about those kind of that's really myths about America.
The thing that you see is this sneering, contemptuous disdain for serious thought, for consideration, for deliberation. I mean, if you looked at, and I, you know, it's not good for my health, so I looked at these people only a little bit. But between her speech and Giuliani's speech, there was this faux populism that comes out, where you have this preposterous vision of a party who, for the last 25 years, has made its business to reward capital and to punish labor, and yet coming forward as a party of the common man. Will this play out? We'll see.
I watched with my wife Debbie the entire Republican convention. Unlike you,
I don't know where
I got the stomach for it, but I watched it, and I had the same reaction you did, and I remember that French term, resentment or ressentiment, which was the way the political scientists described petty bourgeoisie, the kind of like the lower middle class in France, who were the core of the fascist tendency in France, and Palin had that stench of that about her.
Yeah.
I had the same reaction you did.
Yeah. Nixon is still this great book, Nixon Land, which I've started.
It's a fabulous book.
It's a thousand pages, big thick book.
It's very detailed.
But Nixon was the first, and partly because that's where he came from. Nixon was the first to recognize the potential for mining petty bourgeois resentment, fear, and frustration. That mostly he directed downward. He didn't, you know, petty bourgeois fear and resentment can go down or can go up depending on who you are and what your appeal is. Nixon asked the beleaguered, frightened, insecure petty bourgeoisie to look down and to blame its frustrations and its resentments on those below them in the social ladder. And that's the typical way in which fascist mass movements begin to develop. That can happen here. Now, look, I was in Boston when the Palin thing at the American Political Science meeting. So I was around a couple of thousand of professional, you know, my fellow professional social scientists. And the first reaction that people had when the news came that the plane was coming to Dayton, Ohio, bearing the governor of Arkansas is
Governor Alaska, you mean.
Governor Alaska, right. Huh? Who is? Are these people crazy? And who nobody heard of and nobody knew about. For the first day, we were all trying to figure this out. And finally, it really became clear that this is just classic Karl Rove.
Yeah.
This is go to the base, go to the base, go to the base.
Yeah.
And this has been Karl Rove's strategy for as long as he's been around. They can't win with just this.
But they have to get this to win.
That's precisely. Really right. So the whole Rove trip is the country is evenly divided. And what the Republicans have to do to win is consolidate the base first and then pick off enough elements of the Democratic constituency to
carry
them over
the top. They need 15% of the Democrats and 55% of the independents, they figure, and that'll put them in.
That's right. Now, the flip side of this strategy, and this strategy was endorsed by the Clintons years and years. This is where the whole claim is, if the electorate is evenly divided, then you go after the undecided elements of the electorate. Okay. Ask yourselves, after 8 years of this, who can possibly be undecided at this point? Well, now, the answer is that some people are. Generally speaking, political scientists say, and it's true, that undecided voters are generally the most ignorant about public affairs, the least interested in politics, generally speaking, and the most demobilized elements of the population.
Fascinating. Yeah.
Now, as long as you are – so that registered voters who are committed tend to be more political and more involved and more informed. If you buy that the basic Rovian strategy, this is also the strategy of Clinton's third way. That is to say, the country is divided. You go to the middle and you triangulate like mad. There's been this long debate in the Democratic Party about how to react to situations like this. And way back in the 1980s, Jesse Jackson had an alternative model. And the alternative model was you don't go rushing toward the center. You expand the base with a voter registration campaign, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now, the problem with expanding the base is as you appeal to Democratic voters who are not registered, you're going to find that they have a pretty radical set of demands.
Yeah.
Right? And those demands have to be addressed.
Yeah.
They have to be. So the risk for Democratic Party operatives, this comes out of the McGovern thing, and it comes out of all the rules that they adopted in the middle 1970s to prevent a recurrence of the so-called activists taking over the Democratic Party. The risk is that you have the Democratic Party apparatus that on some levels would rather lose than to accommodate the desires and the demands of those who are unregistered.
That's precisely right.
And in Florida,
where the election was stolen from him, Jesse Jackson said, come on, let's have a demonstration and protest this.
And Gore said no.
And the tops of the Democratic Party, including Gore, said no.
Absolutely.
They don't want to mobilize these people because they don't know where it's going to go. In fact, they do know where it's going to go, and they don't want to go.
And it's dangerous. Now, to his credit, and again, we will see what happens on Election Day because this is all in the so-called ground game. To their momentary credit, the Obama people say they understand this. And they say that they are organizing a historic campaign to expand the number of eligible voters, to get them registered, and to make sure that they get to the polls on Election Day. Now, the proof of this will be in the pudding. On some levels, it's just like the debate about Keynesianism being put on the table despite everybody. This is what Obama has to do to win. He's got to do this. If he wants to win, he is going to have to do that which he probably doesn't want to do, and that which certainly the Clinton people in the party have long since resisted. Whether he does it, whether the objective circumstances force him to embrace a more radical organizing strategy on Election Day remains to be seen.
But his position so far is just the opposite. He's rushed over to the center the last 6 weeks with staggering speed. People are shaking their heads.
Position-wise, that's true, but mass organizing has been part of the Obama campaign.
Yeah.
And why I think he has a chance was because of that.
He's going to win because he has the money, and enough people are desperately hopeful enough to believe he's actually going to change something. He's got both. He's going to get the grassroots kids who are crying and wearing the T-shirt and banging on doors, as well as the $400 million.
That's right.
And that's a pretty good combo. And at least a third of the Republican Party wants him to win anyway. Because if you do keep getting free trade momentum, if you're going to bet the outcome now, you bet it for him.
It's been a really great discussion, guys.
Thank you guys for coming down
and being on Law & Disorder. Good to see you, John. Good to see you, Max.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.